Hurry into Menards right now and save big money. Miracle-Gro raised bed soil helps you grow bigger, more bountiful plants. It provides the right foundation your plants need to thrive with a 100% organic formula that requires no mixing. Add Miracle-Gro raised bed soil to help your plants grow with organic nutrients you can count on. Visit our garden center or check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money
at A note before we begin. While we aim to be judicious, there are some descriptions of sexual violence laid out here that can't be avoided to understand the case. Please take care. Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. No one disputes that Andrei Chikatilo endured the worst of Soviet childhoods. Born in 1936 in a small village in Ukraine, his parents were collective farm laborers who had little to offer their children aside from want. As the Soviet communal experiment demanded, his parents were not paid for their work, but were allowed to grow vegetables in the small plot behind the one-room family hut. They could do this after they had toiled long hours in the state-owned fields to feed others. That was all part and parcel of the forced collectivization of agriculture, a political policy as envisioned by the USSR's new leader, Joseph Stalin. The idea? That the work of Andrei Chikatilo's parents, and millions like them, would feed an entire nation. All boats would rise, efficiency and output would be maximized. Ah, utopia. As theory, it may have sounded swell. In practice, it led to, in addition to thousands of other ills, one of the largest famines that area of the world had ever known. It began before Chikatilo was born, when Stalin may have decided to intentionally starve Ukrainians to squelch an independence movement there. Whether or not that was his intention, he succeeded in squelching and in killing as many as 10 million people. The exact death toll is still debated, but historians agree that millions died, several million of them in Ukraine alone. That's why no one questioned Chikatilo's word when he said that he had not tasted bread until he was 12, or that during some of the worst of it, that'd be in 1946 and 1947, his family had to resort to eating grass and leaves to survive. But what Chikatilo said next about his harrowing early years has been debated since the day he was first arrested in 1990. Here he is speaking in a documentary. You'll hear an English translation. The voice of Chikatilo can be heard in the background.
We were sitting in the cellar and our hut was on fire. There were dead and wounded people and they were loading the dismembered bodies in front of me. All those limbs. Then there was the famine. And the whole time my mother used to say to me, don't go anywhere outside the courtyard. They ate your brother Stepan, and they will eat you. They took him and ate him there.
Stepan would have been Chikatilo's older brother, who his family told him was just 4 when he was eaten. It's a harrowing story. But did it happen? The story itself is disturbingly plausible. Cases of cannibalism at this time have been verified, but the absence of evidence in this case, there are no birth or death records of this brother, have forced others to posit that Chikatilo was making himself out to be a victim and not the victimizer he was. Between 1978 and 1990, Chikatilo killed at least 53 boys, girls, and women making him one of the most prolific serial killers in Soviet history. But this episode isn't only about Andrei Chikatilo. It's about a country so committed to the myth of its own perfection that it couldn't bring itself to admit that a monster was walking its train platforms. It's about a legal system that, rather than acknowledge the truth, executed an innocent man for Chikatilo's first murder and then watched him kill at least 52 more. It's about what happens when the story a government tells about itself matters more than the lives of its citizens. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Hims.
I feel like stress gets blamed for a lot of things.
To be fair, stress does cause a lot of things.
True, but at some point, if something is consistently off in the bedroom, guys might want to stop blaming stress and consider actually doing something about it.
I assume that's where Hims comes in.
Exactly. Hims takes away the awkward feeling surrounding ED that causes some guys to punt on handling it.
Because everything's online.
Right. Hims connects you with licensed healthcare providers online, so you get access to legitimate ED treatment options from home.
Which is probably half the battle for some people.
Totally. You complete a simple online intake, a provider reviews your information, and if treatment is right for you, it ships directly to your door in discreet packaging.
So the whole thing is private and straightforward.
Exactly. And that includes Sildenafil, the generic version of Viagra, available through Hims at up to 95% less than the brand name version.
That's a major price difference.
To get simple online access to personalized affordable care for ED, weight loss, and more, visit Hims.com/COTC. That's Hims.com/COTC for your free online visit. Hims.com/COTC.
Prescription required. See website for details and important safety information. Sildenafil is the generic version of Viagra. Viagra is a registered trademark of Viatris Specialty LLC. Hims is not affiliated with or endorsed by Viatris. Earlier, I gave you a content warning. I'm giving a different type of warning here. This episode will require me to pronounce names and places I can only hope to approximate. Please bear with me. It may also require all of us to live in a different space than the one we do here in the U.S., where daily life looks very different, or at least it did in 1978, when Chikatilo started his one-man murder spree. It will ask us to consider the world Andrei Romanovich Chikatilo was born into. That was a Soviet Union that had already been ravaged when Stalin came to power in the first part of the 20th century. The iron-fisted ruler waged a brutal and repressive campaign against those he perceived to be his enemies, executing at least a million and starving millions more. The suffering would continue when Adolf Hitler invaded the Soviet Union in 1941. Our future serial killer would have been 5 years old that year. In the book by Mikhail Krivich and Olger Dolgin called Comrade Chikatilo, the authors quote him as telling later investigators, quote, "I remember the horrors of my childhood years when we hid from bombings and shooting in clears and open pits. We sat in ditches, hungry and cold, fleeing under the whistle of bullets. I remember our burning hut and the savagery of the fascists," end quote. If that weren't enough, he also had bad eyesight, suffered from frequent headaches, wet the bed well into his teens, and was said to have endured relentless bullying for his odd manner. Despite those bad eyes, he had seen too much. Bob Cohen, author of The Killer Department, Detective Viktor Barakov's 8-year hunt for the most savage serial killer in Russian history, told the producers of Annie's biography that
his sister was born in 1943 during a time when the Germans were occupying a large part of Ukraine where he lived. And his father was supposedly in the Red Army at the time. It's hard to imagine how the father could have gotten back to the family home to impregnate the mother. And they had a one-room home. So it's quite possible that he saw a German soldier rape his mother.
And when his father did come home from war, where he had been taken prisoner by the Nazis and later liberated by Americans, he was sick with tuberculosis. Andrei was just 13 when his father returned. And because his father had survived captivity rather than die in battle, the Soviet state eyed him dubiously.
You either died in battle or you triumphed, and there was no third way that was honorable. Stalin's paranoia was such that soldiers who were captured by the Germans and held captive were considered suspect.
It was in the Soviet Union that Andrei Chikatilo came of age, almost inexplicably craving to be a member of the Communist Party, hoping to rebuild a nation that was still reeling from losing 27 million of their own, almost 9 million military and about 18 million civilians, thanks to the Nazi invasion. He was said to be idealistic, though strangely puritanical, a young man who read a lot of books about military triumphs and anything that foretold worldwide communist domination. He was a poor man in a poor country who had managed to become more educated than most, having made it through the 10th grade and into technical school. He felt screwed over because he would later say he had passed all the exams to get into the prestigious Moscow State University, but had been turned down. He figured that because his father had, rather unfortunately for Andrei, been taken as a prisoner of war by the Nazis but liberated by the Allies, their fellow countrymen believed he was now spying for the Americans. He wasn't. But no one wanted that man's progeny to move up in life or up the communist ladder. So here's a man with no natural gifts to help him in life, no breaks, no pull, no clout, no charm. And he had one other pretty significant obstacle to living what most would consider an ordinary happy life. He was impotent, at least with others. This we know dated from at least 1955, when he would have been 19. Sexually troubled, perhaps, but not without ambition. As a young adult, he went to the Urals to work construction, landed in Siberia, where the cold is famously unbearable and the summer is hot and filled with bugs that want to eat you before winter comes. The loner still managed. He took correspondence courses through the Moscow Electromechanical Institute, thinking he might make a good communications engineer. With that, he could now call himself university educated. He proudly put that on the old resume. He was called up for military service and, after that, decided to settle near the town of Rostovodon, a busy riverfront port in southwestern Russia, about 300 miles from the Ukrainian border. Chikatilo got a job in his field as a communications engineer, but took a side gig doing freelance journalism for a local paper, writing feature stories and covering some minor sports. He was working hard to improve his interpersonal skills and talking to people. That was something which was often hard for him, but necessary to succeed in that second job. It had the effect of bolstering his self-esteem. His first journalistic effort was a small piece about one of his co-workers, a woman he was interested in getting to know better. He thought the story would please her. It did. But he had no idea how to keep her interest. It was that way with women. Always. His sister, Tatiana, watched as he suffered. Finally, when he was 27, she introduced him to, bear with me here, Semyonova Adnacheva, who blessedly went by Fenya for short. She was no beauty, but she worked hard and seemed to share some of Chikatila's more introverted traits. They were married in 1963. They stayed together for the next 27 years. She spoke of their lives together only when she gave testimony, as recounted in Comrade Chikatilo. Quote, "We never had any intimate relations before we were married. From our very first night together, I sensed that he was sexually impotent. He could not consummate the sexual act without my help. At the time, I attributed it to shyness or modesty on his part." End quote. Sex remained fraught, but they managed to conceive two children, the first in 1965, the second 4 years later. Andrei became a member of the Communist Party and, because of that, was given a party-approved job as the chairman of the Regional Committee for Physical Education and Sports. That required him to inspect facilities, give a lot of encouraging party-forward speeches to aspiring athletes, and be on hand for competitions and award ceremonies. It was here he found the proximity to nubile young people a little too thrilling. So much so that in 1970, with a wife and two small children in tow, he quit his party job and took a job teaching Russian language and literature at Novoshakhtinsk Boarding School No. 32. Novoshakhtinsk was a mining town located on the border between Russia and Ukraine. He was 34 years old, with little about him that was remarkable or even memorable. His colleagues quickly found him absent-minded and marginally disdainful of meetings and edicts and rules. In short, a poor worker. His students found him strange. They also found him hovering, regularly leaning in to touch them, to graze their teenaged breasts or behinds as he moved past them. He could also be seen by them, standing in front of the class, hands in his pockets, fondling himself. No one said much about it. He was just considered a strange dude and probably, they thought, gay. And yet, sometimes he would walk into the girls' dorm at night, just about the time they'd be getting ready for bed, just checking in. Then on one occasion, in May 1973, he took his class on a swimming outing. He apparently followed a 14-year-old girl into the lake, separating her from the others. He began touching her breasts, pulling on her suit. She screamed. He told her to scream louder. When she did, everyone there saw the encounter. He let her go. Despite the fact that she was crying and had suffered physical injuries from the interaction, nothing was done, even after parents were told. A few days later, Chikatilo asked a student who was struggling with her work to stay after class for some tutoring. When she did, and the others had left, he locked the classroom door and began to claw at her, scratching her in the process. When she saw an opening, she ran to a window and jumped out of it. This time, the good Communist Party member, quote-unquote, voluntarily retired from the boarding school job. He moved on to a job at a vocational school for boys in the same town, which provided housing. By now, Chikatilo found that young male bodies were also of interest to him. Again, the authors of Comrade Chikatilo noted how his life was getting more complicated on a variety of fronts. Quote, he continued to write newspaper articles about bringing up children in a spirit of morality and patriotism. He also became a freelance employee for another organization, the Department of Internal Affairs, that is, the police, for whom he became an informer, end quote. He moved his family across town. Things escalated now as he took to wandering around the pupils' quarters at night, sometimes accidentally awakening them, where they would find him with his head on their bellies. But it was not discussed. Who were they to tell? Their superiors? He was a party member. That wasn't wise. The police? Well, he worked for the police. The newspaper? Don't be ridiculous. Maybe Chikatilo knew he was playing with fire. Now he took to looking for children on playgrounds, finding that he liked to touch them and hurt them when no one was looking. It was sometime in 1977 or 78 that he engaged the former wife of his wife's brother in a casual relationship that somehow turned into a sexual one. It would be the only time in his life that he had what could be considered a quote-unquote normal relationship with a woman. Or maybe she just didn't mind his quirks? It's hard to know. In any case, even with limited income, he bought a one-room shed to make their rendezvous less complicated. It's not known if Andrei's wife knew or even suspected that he was cheating on her. It might not have mattered, because his transgressions were about to get much, much worse. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Home Chef. We are officially in that end of the school year stretch where everybody's tired, everybody's busy, and no matter what we do, we go to bed feeling like we forgot to do 1,000 things.
Yeah, this is the time of year where even basic decisions start to feel exhausting.
Which is why I'm always grateful for Home Chef. It removes one entire category of stress from the week.
And specifically, the what are we making for dinner stress.
Right, because Home Chef sends fresh ingredients with recipes that are actually easy to follow, so there's already a plan in place. There's basically an option for whatever level of energy you have that day.
And cleanup is easy, which matters a lot when you're already trying to keep up with everything else. No huge shopping list, no complicated prep.
So Home Chef does the planning part for us, which is probably the only reason dinner still resembles an organized activity around here.
And Home Chef is rated number one by users of other meal kits for quality, convenience, value, taste, and recipe ease.
And it saves money, too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 a month on groceries. For a limited time, Home Chef is offering my listeners 50% off and free shipping for your first box, plus free dessert for life. Go to homechef.com/COTC.
That's homechef.com/COTC for 50% off your first box and free dessert for life.
Homechef.com/COTC. Must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert. About 45 miles outside of Rostovodon sits the mining town of Shakhty. It lies on the rail line between Rostov and Moscow. It's a working town in the unending gray Russian landscape where, in the late 1970s, both men and women were tragically overworked and undercared for. Its water wasn't clean, its forests littered, and its children unwatched. When he could now, Andrei Chikatilo was roaming the region's transport centers, the bus and rail lines, looking for those he could molest without consequence. These places were busy and oftentimes full of transients, sex workers, and others who were a bit down on their luck. On December 22, 1978, Chikatilo spotted a 9-year-old girl in a red hooded coat swinging a school bag. Lenachka Zakhanova had a good day at school, taken a dance class after, gone home and put on her skates to go on to the frozen river nearby. A friend joined her there. Lenachka told her friend how the day before she had been given some imported chewing gum by a nice man she had seen often by the station. She said the two usually just talked a bit. The classmates said that when Lenachka showed her friends the treat, they asked her to see if she could get them some more. "Let's go find the man," she said. Her friend declined and watched as Lenachka walked to the station. She was last seen around 6 that evening with a man who was leaning over, quietly talking to her. Witnesses could later describe him and the girl and what they were both wearing that day. Later, it would be determined that Chikatilo took her to a nearby shed where he, in his own words, quote, "pounced on her, crushing her under me," end quote. This description will be unpleasant but brief. He began to tear her clothes off. She screamed. He tried but did not succeed in raping her, instead opting to masturbate to ejaculation. He then manually put his sperm inside her vagina, ripping at her flesh. Then he strangled her, redressed her, took her to the river, and threw her into the rushes. It was the first time he had killed anyone, and he found it was beyond satisfying. Her body was found a few days later. Chikatilo sat tight, worrying that he'd be questioned and detained any minute. But word soon came that police had arrested Alexander Kravchenko, a 25-year-old who had previously served time in prison for rape and murder. Though those crimes usually brought the death penalty with them, Kravchenko had been only 18 when he committed them, earning him an abbreviated 15-year sentence. He'd been released early. But now he lived very close to where this little girl was found. That was the only evidence they had against him. His alibi stood up until the police forced the two women who vouched for him to recant under threat of losing custody of their own children. After days of interrogation, Kravchenko confessed, then changed his mind, but it was too late for any of that. He was sentenced to death. Much, much later, Mistakes like this, so early on, haunted the authorities.
Leonid Akubjanov, the judge who convicted Chikatilo, calls it a tragedy. The police and the prosecutors had good reason to suspect Chikatilo. That's the most terrible thing. Chikatilo was seen with a girl. They made an identikit picture which looked like him. If Kravchenko, who was shot, had not been convicted, then they might have convicted Chikatilo instead. And there wouldn't have been all those terrible murders which followed. Those 52 murders.
Chikatilo decided to keep a low profile. He changed where he worked and where his family lived. He tried to step away from those who might be suspicious of his predatory behaviors and report him. He also stepped away from the children who excited him. No one knows if these were attempts to end his behavior or merely to better hide it. In March 1981, he took a new job, this time as a supply clerk for Rostov-on-Arud, a huge industrial complex. His wife also got a job there. And supply clerks were just that, scavengers of things working in a repressed economy where it was catch-as-catch-can. They were procurers in a land that was not ruled by supply and demand, but by favor and fear. Thus, Chikatilo traveled a lot and had access to a lot of things that ordinary consumers had little access to. He would later say that life on the road made him what he was.
We were brought up to believe that all sex was harmful, that we must only work in industry and build communism. All the rest was unnecessary. It was useless. And I was convinced that if it was unnecessary, it didn't matter if I couldn't get my thing to stand up. I wasn't sorry. But all this pressed down on my brain. I didn't want to go there, but the people kept coming, masses of them. You have to lie with beggars for the whole night at railway stations when you go on a business trip, because there are never any vacancies in the hotels. So the people went there, and so did I. I watched a couple of times, and then I became infected. It's just like drugs.
On September 3rd, 1981, he saw Larissa Kachenko at the Rostov Library and somehow convinced her to walk with him along the River Don. He took her down a forest path on what may have been an agreement for consensual sex. When he failed to get an erection, he hit her with his fist, put dirt in her mouth, and strangled her. After he had achieved his own orgasm, the violence was the key, he found. He put his sperm in her vagina and rectum. Then he shoved a stick into her vagina and bit off one of her nipples. He had not carried a knife that day and regretted it. He would, from that point forward, use an array of 23 different knives to incapacitate his victims. Another year passed. Then he killed 13-year-old Lubov Biruk, stabbing her 40 times. He later told investigators, quote, "The flow of blood, coupled with the victim's agony, brought me pleasure, and I continued stabbing her," end quote. There was little to stop him now. He took a month's vacation away from his family. This was at his wife's insistence, as she thought he needed the rest. While away, he raped and killed 14-year-old Lyuba Voloburyev in a sorghum field near Krasnodar Airport. Then he killed Oleg Pozidayev, a 9-year-old boy. And after that, he killed and mutilated 16-year-old Olga Kuprinya. The total, as I said in the intro, will be at least 53. There's no way I can chronicle them all in detail here. Please know that's not a slight. They deserve to be recognized for the mothers and daughters and brothers and sons that they were. I'm sorry I can't honor them more appropriately, because they matter. By the end of 1982, Chikatilo had killed 7. In 1983, he killed 9 more. In 1984, 15. At first, his victims tended to be women who he perceived needed his help in some way. Directions, maybe, or a few dollars in exchange for a quickie. He would lead them into nearby wooded areas around the train stations, for example, with promises of something. Then he typically would be careful to stand apart from them when he first drew blood to escape the spatter. He made no attempt to bury his victims, though he would sometimes cover them with leaves or newspapers, whatever was handy. As the killing progressed, he'd often cut into his victims, then remove their genitals and take their eyes. In some cases, it's not known what he did exactly, as the bodies, when found, were skeletal remains. This often left police with little to work with from an investigation standpoint. As his body count climbed, he didn't much care what sex or age his victims were. Their ages ranged from 9 to 45. He was opportunistic, learning to carry a briefcase with him at all times. In it, he carried a towel, rope, Vaseline, an ID card that identified him as a freelance cop, and sometimes a frying pan. And though he maintained that he had not eaten their flesh, there is plenty of evidence to suggest he did, as victims were often missing both small and large parts of their anatomy upon discovery. It would not be ridiculous to ask right about now what the hell the Russian authorities were doing about this rash of seemingly similar and decidedly gruesome deaths in and around the Rostov Oblast. There are two answers to that question. The first is something I alluded to earlier. In the British short documentary Andrei Chikatilo, The Butcher of Rostov, the presenter explained about the authorities' initial reluctance to look for a single killer in these cases.
Because the Soviet Union denied the existence of serial killers, it didn't fit the narrative of a socialist utopia. The idea of a sexual predator hunting citizens was politically unacceptable. Instead, innocent people were arrested, tortured into confessions, and in some cases, executed. Meanwhile, Chikatilo kept killing.
The second answer to the question about what was being done is that while they were late to get started, they were about to do something, and that's throw the full force of their law enforcement might at it. Once they realized what they had on their hands, there was no more pretending. The official story, that serial killers didn't exist in the Soviet Union, would have to wait. They had bodies to account for. Because many of the crimes had taken place in and around shelter belts, I think we call them windbreaks, you know, areas planted in busy places to reduce wind, erosion, and dust, the task force was given the name Operation Shelter Belt. In some media outlets, that was translated to Operation Forest Strip. It was a small operation at first, formed in 1983 by Lieutenant Viktor Barakov, head of the Serious Crimes Division for the Rostov Police. It would grow in 1985 when Isa M. Kostoyev, deputy director of the Department of Violent Crime in the Soviet Prosecutor's Office, took over. It's easy to understand why. The number of dead was rising fast, with 30 bodies now attached to this killer. The fire was truly lit by the death of 17-year-old Natalia Shalopinina, who was found within about 20 yards of her home.
Under Kostoyev's command, one of the largest police operations in Soviet history was mounted. Over the next 5 years, police were to check almost 500,000 people, a figure equivalent to 1 in 10 of the entire population of the Rostov region. More than 1,000 people were convicted for other crimes they solved along the way, but not Chikatilo. He remained at large, always one step ahead of them.
Kostoyev was nothing if not methodical and thorough. He considered every possibility, that it was maybe more than one man doing the killing, that now there were copycat killings, that they bore no relation to one another. In order to check every lead, every possibility, the authorities spoke to 160,000 owners of private cars in and around the locations where the crimes were taking place. They checked the relevant whereabouts of 2,475 men who had previous convictions for sexual crimes. They rounded up every innocent drifter who somebody thought was acting suspiciously. They even made sure they checked the blood types of anyone they came across. Still, their killer continued to murder with impunity. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Hiya Health. I feel like the end of the school year turns every parent into a slightly sleep-deprived cruise director. And meanwhile, we're still trying to feed everybody reasonably well.
Which is harder than it sounds when your kid lives off hamburgers and turkey and cheese sandwiches.
That's one reason we started using Hiya. I knew we wanted a vitamin to close the gaps, and I also knew that a lot of kids' vitamins are basically candy with a health halo. Hiya went the opposite direction. Zero sugar, no gummy additives, just clean nutrition. And somehow, the kiddo genuinely likes them.
Which is one less thing to remember during the chaos of May.
And here's something every parent needs to hear. If getting your kids to eat vegetables feels like an impossible daily battle, Hiya's new Kids Daily Greens Plus Superfoods is a total game changer. It's basically chocolate milk stuffed with veggies. It's a green powder designed specifically for kids that's packed with 55 plus whole food sourced ingredients. Just mix one scoop with milk or milk alternative and watch them actually enjoy something that's secretly fueling their growing bodies. And we've worked out a special deal with Hiya for their best-selling children's vitamin. Receive 50% off your first order. To claim this deal, you must go to hiyahealth.com/COTC. This deal is not available on their regular website. Go to hiyahealth.com/COTC and get your kids the full body nourishment they need to grow into healthy adults. Andre Chikatilo was not exactly thriving. His bosses thought his supply work was suffering from a distinct lack of attention. He was reprimanded daily for his daydreaming and inability to focus on tasks at hand. At first, that kind of workplace humiliation didn't seem to bother him much. Remember, he was not a very social guy and not that friendly with his peers. But the resentment slowly built, and he eventually began openly complaining to others of his mistreatment. This did not go well with his superiors. But it was difficult to remove a party member from any job, so he was allowed to continue wandering the region, ostensibly for work, with his time relatively unaccounted for. His job, aside from its freedom from scrutiny, also gave him access to goods that might have been difficult for others to obtain. He could easily pocket extra staples like meat and sugar, or consumer items like appliances. If he was careful, he could even nab the occasional imported luxury that most Soviet citizens could only dream of. It must have been a rush to get his hands on things his comrades couldn't. Come 1984, Chikatilo got sloppy and greedy, boosting a roll of linoleum and a car battery for himself. When he was found out, the party leaders had the perfect excuse to get rid of him. The communists weren't going to support a guy who had taken state property. The Shakti cops were called in, and Chikatilo bumbled through an interrogation. But before the authorities were even finished with him, he left to look for work elsewhere. He found it in his old digs, Rostov. Another large industrial firm took him on as their supply clerk. So much for checking references. And the guys in Shakti didn't chase him down. They were just happy he was out of their hair. It was a win-win. Especially for Chikatilo, because the new job gave him even wider berth, most specifically to take frequent trips to places like Uzbekistan. His bloodlust became almost frenzied now. He took to killing before, during, and after trips away, spending nights in his office at his desk, rarely changing clothes. He would take his clothes off in station bathrooms to wash whatever had gotten on his trousers. Something about him seemed suspicious to Captain Alexander Zanozovsky, who, with his partner, followed him one day for hours, watching him approach various women who refused his advances. When they eventually stopped him, he began to sweat, mumble, and dissemble, more than likely because he knew of the criminal charges he had evaded when he slipped out of Shakti. They arrested him and asked to look into his briefcase, which, if you remember, was basically a travel-friendly kill kit. He complied. They were alarmed by its contents. Zanozovsky thought they had at last found the man they were all looking for. Charged with the lesser crime of harassing women, the police could legally hold him for 2 weeks while they looked into his background and his whereabouts at the time of the various murders. They took a blood sample, but did not get a sperm sample because, as Viktor Borokov later explained, they had no idea how to ask a family man and party member to provide them with it. Too embarrassing for all concerned, they decided, never mind. Everything they turned up checked a box for the serial killer, except his blood type. He was type A. The killer was AB. They knew that from typing the semen left at the crime scenes. Now, this was a hard pill to swallow. Zanozovsky knew this was the guy, but had nothing to tie him to the murders. All they had now was the car battery theft charge. For that, he served 3 months in jail. His briefcase and its contents were returned to his wife, who later said she put the knives inside of it back in her kitchen drawer. The worst outcome for Chikatilo was this. The Communist Party officially invalidated his party status. But things were changing in the USSR. Mikhail Gorbachev, the man who would effectively dismantle it, was now serving as the last general secretary of its Communist Party and, in 1990, became its first and only president. Chikatilo's disappointment was assuaged by where he saw it all going. Personally, he knew he needed a new job, but easily found one in January 1985, this time in Novochurkask, a city that was halfway between Rostov and Shakhty. It was a good job that required travel. The next woman he killed was 18 and mentally challenged. Then there was a runaway, some boys, one who was 12 and mentally challenged, and then some more women. The number and frequency began to slow because, by now, police had dramatically increased surveillance of area trains and train stations. Female officers were placed strategically as decoys to lure the killer out. The public had become aware of the danger now, though mostly by word of mouth, as it was not the Soviet media's job to print bad news. Later, a judge would make his feelings about that known.
Local people were not informed at all, even after Chikatilo had already committed tens of murders and they'd been hunting him for years. Children were being killed, but everyone remained silent. If they'd spoken out loud about this, written on every street corner that children had disappeared and in what circumstances, then people would have been careful. People would have been on the lookout at bus stops. No, everyone was silent.
Still, volunteer militiamen joined the hunt in June of 1986 as a way to check documents and stop the odd man who looked or acted suspiciously. Andrei Chikatilo was one of the volunteers. So he slowed down his attacks. This was something that experts would later say meant that he was sane, that he could control his urges if he thought he might be in danger of being found out. He figured he was ahead of them. He saw their obvious traps, their checkpoints. He would change where he killed. He killed a 9-year-old boy in Ilovask, Ukraine in May 1988. Then he circled back to familiar environs. He killed a 16-year-old boy while taking a commuter train home. He killed on business trips, on his way to a family birthday party, while swimming. Forensics seemed to suggest that, by now, with all his success, he was prolonging his victims' deaths, enjoying their pain, their moaning as they bled out. And that way, the rapes that preceded the murders were not atypical. It was not about sex. It was about power. The hunt for the sadist intensified. Each time someone or something suspicious was noted, a card full of information was made by the officer who had done the stopping, and file clerks kept busy cross-referencing the cards and filing them for future use. The cards stacked up. They were getting closer. A train ticket had been found on the last victim. The woman who sold the ticket remembered that he was with a man whom she then described. She also told police that her daughter had seen that same man asking another boy to get on the train with him. Both had a great memory for faces. On November 6, 1990, Andrei Chikatilo convinced 22-year-old Svetlana Korostik to get off the station platform at Leskoz and follow him into the shelter belt. Here is Amirkan Yandiev, head of the Serious Crimes Unit in Rostov.
One of our plainclothes officers did notice a man coming out of the wood, scratched all over. As we were to discover later, this was Chikatilo.
That officer was Sergeant Igor Rybakov. He also noticed that the man had leaves and tiny branches on the back of his coat, and there was a streak of blood on his cheek. Rybakov talked to the man, who seemed quite confident and unfazed by the questioning. The officer took down his name, filled out a card, and let him go. The name did not come up at the weekly meeting at Operation Shelter Belt headquarters because it had not yet been filed, and Svetlana's body hadn't yet been found. When it was, authorities remembered that Sergeant Rybakov had stopped a man nearby on approximately the day she would have died. They pulled his cards, he had six on file, and set about finding where this Chikatilo was when the 9-year-old Alyosha Vronko was murdered in the interior region of Ukraine. On November 20th, Chikatilo took off from work to have his hand looked at by a doctor. It had been painful for weeks, ever since one of his victims had bitten his finger in a fight for his life. The doctor found the finger was broken and put it in a cast. Later that afternoon, Chikatilo left his house to get a beer, but not before he separately approached two young boys on the street. The first was gathered up by an older woman before Chikatilo could get very far. The second was called home and turned away. The police had been watching this in an unmarked vehicle and had videotaped both encounters. If they weren't sure before, they were sure now. He was arrested on the spot, and he was carrying a briefcase. Science evolves. It has to. In this case, sometime between Andrei Chikatilo's first blood sample was taken, when he was determined to have type A blood, medical researchers discovered something odd and very rare. Seems that a very few people with type AB blood can mistakenly show up as type A because the B antigen is barely visible in the blood, but readily seen in hair, saliva, and, yes, semen. After Chikatilo's arrest, they put him in a special holding cell at the KGB headquarters in Rostov and gave this special prisoner a fake name and said he was there under a different charge, all for his protection. And they quickly got that sperm sample.
No one, not even Chikatilo himself, could have known that he was a one-in-a-million exception.
The implications were obvious. If someone had asked earlier for that sperm sample when he was in custody and they had had the chance, far fewer people would have died at this man's hand. Chikatilo initially pleaded innocent to everything, but quickly changed course. That became clear 2 days after his arrest when he addressed the Prosecutor General of Russia in writing. Quote, "I felt a kind of madness and ungovernability and perverted sexual acts. I couldn't control my actions because from childhood I was unable to realize myself as a real man and a complete human being." End quote. It was a vague confession at best. Soon, he wrote a new, tad less vague letter to the prosecutor general. Quote, "My inconsistent behavior should not be misconstrued as an attempt to avoid responsibility for any acts I have committed. Everything I have done makes me shudder. I only feel gratitude toward the investigating bodies for having captured me." End quote. Officials decided to have his wife visit him in jail. Psychiatrists followed. They came away fairly certain his mental illness was so profound that he would not stand trial. Interrogations continued. Then, on November 30th, he began to tell Lieutenant Viktor Burokov everything. In fact, his confession was so detailed and covered so many deaths that it took 6 days for it all to be told and taken down. Experts then took 2 months to determine if he was mentally competent. They found he was. He seemed to delight in the process.
In the weeks that followed, Chikatilo took his captors on a macabre tour of his killings, amazing them with the accuracy of his memory. even 10 years after he had killed, he was still able to pinpoint the place down to a few meters.
He was handing them all the proof they needed. His trial began on April 14, 1992, with the ordinary-looking defendant seated in a cage for his own protection. It would be remembered as one of the most dramatic trials in Russian history. By now, he was being labeled the Red Ripper, the Rostov Ripper, and the Butcher of Rostov. As much as was allowed, American newspapers reported from inside the courtroom. Video from those first days of the trial shows rows of Russian women, some of them with their heads wrapped in babushkas, their faces worn and scarred with grief, shrieking as Chikatilo entered the courtroom. He shrieked back. The trial took 6 months to conclude, given that each of the murders had to be detailed, with exhibits offered up and testimony elicited from police and family members of the dead. The details were so awful that even the guards around Chikatilo's cage succumbed to fainting and tears. As the proceedings began to wind down, he withdrew his confession. He became incoherent and nonsensical, claiming he was framed. His defense attorney tried to argue that he was insane and thus not responsible for his actions. Some doctors agreed with that. Others found his plotting and his premeditation proof that he knew what he was doing. This is from the Getty Archives.
Hundreds of people pushed their way into the courtroom to hear the verdict on a man who terrorized their community for 12 years. For a second successive day, he refused to sit in silence, aiming an incoherent stream of abuse at his captors. The judges read out the final pages of their verdict, confirming Chikatilo's guilt and rejecting his pleas of insanity. As they read, doctors rushed to help the sister of one of the victims. So appalling have the details of this case been that medical teams have had to be on permanent standby in court. Then, finally, the sentence.
Chikatilo, in the name of the Russian Federation, I sentence you to death.
Predictably, the crowd approved the result. Chikatilo struggled with his warders, then screamed at the judge, "You're a crook, you're a crook." Across the court, the mother of one of his victims struggled to get at the cage, while another shouted, "Death to him, kill the beast."
By now, for her own safety, his wife Fenya had been whisked out of Rostov, given a new identity, and planted somewhere in Ukraine, never to be heard from again. Before he was to meet the firing squad, reporters were given access to him. He said things like,
"I'm nothing but an actor who's performed a role to earn an Oscar and to get into the Guinness Book of Records, that's all. Let the person who's written the scenario for all this explain it to the people. I'm asked, describe how it all happened. But what can I explain when they didn't show me the case file? They hid it. They're hiding it all. They've put great things in there, painting me as a beast, that's all. And now people look at me. They must put up with me here."
In another interview, he said that his dream growing up was to become a dictator. Quote, "After the ninth grade, after Stalin died, I was ready to become general secretary and inherit all of governmental control," end quote. Asked about the afterlife and what fate he might meet in his, he shrugged and said he'd never bothered to think about it. The wannabe dictator died on February 14, 1994, after taking a single government-issued bullet to the back of his head. He is buried in the Novocherkassk prison cemetery. Russian psychiatrist Alexander Bukhanovsky came to national renown by working closely with Chikatilo and other prolific serial killers. He would be very busy in years to come. According to newspaper reports in the Moscow Times, the London Guardian, and the Los Angeles Times, the 1990s were particularly difficult years in Rostov-on-Don. In that decade alone, in that riverfront city alone, police caught 29 multiple murderers and rapists. By then, the town was known as the serial killer capital of Russia. There was no pretending anymore that this was a utopia. To research and write this report, journalist Amy Wilson read Comrade Chikatilo, The Psychopathology of Russia's Most Notorious Serial Killer by Mikhail Krivich and Olgurt Olgin. The authors had access to 225 volumes of evidence, transcripts of interrogations, both audio and video, and the findings of Moscow's Serbsky Psychiatric Institute, which they liberally cited. Amy also had to acquaint herself with Soviet history, especially the Holodomor famine, conditions post-World War II, and life just prior to Glasnost. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're @centuriespod. And you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.